All right.
So that was a computer voice, by the way.
That's right. Okay. I'm not sure what accent that
was. It's not a Canadian computer voice. That's just a regular computer voice. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, so I say stupid things, you know.
You sound it. Not that you say stupid things, but you sound like you're from Brooklyn. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm originally from Brooklyn.
Yeah. Nice recovery there, Kelly. Okay.
No, I was...
I'm joking with you.
I know you are.
Okay. So, welcome, everyone, to the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for January the 29th, 2020. And the first thing I'm going to do is call the roll. And I have all the names in front of me, so this is much easier than it used to be. I have Ann Hendricks, John O'Malley, Philip Ferruggio, Barry Zwicker, Kelly David, Steve Stadola, Mike Cook,
yes.
Fern Tischman, Pat O'Connell, Craig McKee, myself, Marie Spike, and Dylan Avery. And who is the person with the 617-730 number?
That's me, Greg Flynn. I just dialed in.
Okay, great. Okay, Greg Flynn is on there too. Terrific. So that's who we've got, at least to start. All right. Okay. So the first thing on our agenda, a little bit of just housekeeping to start. The minutes that Ann Hendricks prepared for us were sent out, and a little bit of a revision was done on the weekend, and that sent out. Are there any changes to propose, or any objections to the minutes being adopted as distributed? Excellent. And next would be the draft agenda. Is everybody good with the draft agenda that was distributed? All right. Okay, great. Well, so then hold on a second here. So our first speaker is Philip Ferruggio, and he's a frequent contributor he's a contributing editor to the Greenville Post, and a contributor also to Global Research, Nation of Change, World News Trust, and Off Guardian sites. And he's also the host of the radio show It's the Empire, Stupid. And Philip's going to talk to us tonight about the military-industrial empire and military spending. And if there's anything I've left out, then he'll fill you in on that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Okay, greetings. I have a lot of things to cover. I only have 20 minutes. A lot of what I'm going to say, a lot of you already know, so it'll be probably redundant. But in America, with a K, we are living in an empire that celebrates militarism. You know, you drive your car, you see the license plates, proud mom of a Marine, U.S. Navy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I live in Central Florida now, and I see it all the time. You watch any sporting event, there's a giant flag across the stadium or the arena. They bring out the honor guard, usually a lot of them are dressed in camouflage. You figure out why. Pledge of Allegiance, Star-Spangled Banner, and it goes on and on. So how have we gotten to this point? Well, if you want to go back, you can go back to after World War II, but basically in the 21st century, we've got to this point with the illegal and immoral Iraq invasion, when both political parties kept voting for that supplemental funding that the Bush-Cheney cabal needed to continue the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. So it was a bipartisan effort.
James Hufford.
It was a bipartisan effort of
Hi, James.
Both parties. Now, after the phony invasion, a really funny organization was formed by the U.S. government, the Coalition Provisional Authority. And they took money from the Iraqis and they dished it out to a number of international corporations. They justified the robbery as compensation for, quote, lost profits and decline in business. due to, I'm not making this up, I mean, it's what they say, due to the aggressive actions of Saddam Hussein since 1990. Where I come from in New York, my friends would call that chutzpah. Now, believe it or not, this, I'm not making this up, U.S.-based corporations like Sheraton Hotels received $11 million of that money. Bechtel got $7 million. Mobil got $2.3 million. Even Kentucky Fried Chicken got $321,000. And Toys R Us got $190,000. Now, listen to this. Israeli farmers received $8 million. Why? Well, they were not able to harvest fully due to the threat from Saddam's regime. Plus, Israeli hotel and travel agency corporations received $15 million. Now, this was all going on while 500,000 Iraqi citizens lost their jobs, and soon after, about 50% of the workforce became unemployed. And people now ask why they want us the hell out of their country. Well, when they ended the so-called war in Iraq in 2011, 7 million Iraqis lived below the poverty line. Large amounts of their money were paid out to those infamous and humanitarian U.S. corporations for local projects. Most were never completed. Corruption was rampant by all parties concerned, Iraqi and American. So this is where things start in the 21st century. And let's see where we are now. This is from a piece by William Hartung and Mandy Smithberger. It was on Global Research. He's the director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. It's a long name, but he's into, you know, military spending. He and Mandy are really into this. And this they wrote back in May when the Trump administration was asking for this money, this increase for the Pentagon and related defense. The Trump administration wanted $750 billion. Now, this is how, by the way, the Democrats and Republicans together gave more money. They actually issued more than $750 billion. So that tells you about the two-party system. The Pentagon's base budget, that's the regular budget, that was slated to be $544 billion in fiscal year 2020. Now, that base budget provides basic operating funds for the Department of Defense, much of which will actually be probably squandered on preparations for ongoing wars that are never authorized by Congress, overpriced weapons that aren't actually needed, or outright waste, an expansive category that includes everything from cost overruns to unnecessary bureaucracy. So that's the $544 billion, okay? Then we come to the war budget. Now, as if its regular budget wasn't enough, the Pentagon wants a little bit more for their own slush fund, formerly known to the public as Overseas Contingency Operations Account, or OCO. In theory, the fund is meant to pay for the war on terror, that is, the U.S. wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and anywhere else in the Middle East or Africa that we decide to go into. So that's the base budget, and that's the, war budget, which is $173 billion. So now we have a running total of $727.9 billion. Now we come to the nuclear budget. That's $24.8 billion. Now the tally is up to $752.7 billion. Then we have defense-related activities. You can figure what that out is. What that is, that's $9 billion. Now we're up to $761 billion. Now we have the Veterans Affairs budget, which is important, obviously. Now, it's funny because more than almost 7,000 U.S. military personnel have died in Washington's post-9/11 wars, with probably more than 30,000 wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan alone. Now, these are just the tip of the iceberg. Hundreds of thousands of returning troops, you folks probably know this, they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, illnesses created by exposure to toxic burn pits or traumatic brain injuries. The U.S. government is committed to providing care for these veterans for the rest of their lives. So the analysis by the Course of War Project at Brown University determined that obligations to veterans of the Iraq and Afghan so-called, I call them so-called wars, alone will total more than $1 trillion in the years to come. The Veterans Affairs total in this budget is $216 billion. So now the running total is $977 billion. Then you have the Homeland Security budget. That's a mega agency created after 9/11. At that time, it swallowed up 22 then existing government organizations, creating a department that in addition has a quarter of a million employees. Quarter of a million employees. That budget was $69.2 billion. Now the running total is over $1 trillion. Then we have the international affairs budget. You figure what that mumbo-jumbo is supposed to be. That's $51 billion. So now we have $1.0979 trillion. Then we come to the intelligence budget. We have 17 separate intelligence agencies. And we know very little about the nature of this intelligence spending, other than it's supposed to be released every year. By now, it's more than $80 billion. So you add that $80 billion onto the running total, it's well over $1 trillion. And finally, we have the defense share of interest on the national debt. So for now, of the more than $500 billion in interest that we taxpayers fork over to service this government debt, about $156 billion can be attributed to Pentagon spending. So the final total is $1.25 trillion. And it just keeps going on and on. And what I'd like to do now, if I could, is talk to you folks about what really bothers me, and I'm sure it might bother you too. Now, we have an election coming up, and we have a Democratic Party that wants to unseat Donald Trump. Right now, the impeachment stuff is going on TV, if you folks, you probably know that, but anyway, it's been going on and off. Hmm. Now, this is from the Gray Zone. That's another wonderful website, by the way, folks. The Gray Zone, really good. And this is from Kevin Gostola. G-O-S-Z, as in zebra, T-O-L-A. And he wrote a piece just the other day. He talks about what this Democratic Party, the National Party, is really doing behind the scenes. The National Committee Chairman, Tom Perez, he has nominated dozens of lobbyists, corporate consultants, think tank board members, and former officials linked to Barack Obama and Bill and Hillary Clinton's presidential campaigns to serve on the Democratic National Convention Nominating Committee. Okay, many of these appointees are vocal opponents of Senator Bernie Sanders, all right? And it looks like they're going to try to sabotage Sanders again, as they did in the past. But let me just tell you some of the people that Tom Perez has picked to be on this committee. Dennis McDonough was nominated to chair the platform committee. McDonough was Obama's chief of staff during his second term. McDonough is senior principal for the Markle Foundation and a chair of the WeWork America Task Force. They have great names for these organizations. And acting on behalf of the CIA, in the past, McDonough pushed for more redactions in the torture report summary that was ultimately released by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. He was a close ally of CIA Director John Brennan, and he fought for Brennan when the Senate delayed Brennan's nomination over his past support for torture. McDonough also advised Obama on how to develop the drone program, which involved a kill list of alleged terrorism suspects to be assassinated extrajudicially. Okay, now Perez nominated Jake Sullivan to be vice chair of the platform committee. Sullivan was a national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. He also worked as a deputy chief of staff for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and was a senior policy advisor for Clinton's 2016 campaign. But more importantly, Sullivan is a member of the Alliance, now listen to this name, the Alliance for Securing Democracy's Advisory Council. Alliance for Securing Democracy. This is their advisory council. Look at the people it includes. Michael Chertoff, the former Homeland Security Secretary. Bill Kristol, with a K, a neoconservative who pushed for the Iraq War. Michael McFaul, the former United States Ambassador to Russia. Mike Morrell, former CIA Director. John Podesta, former Clinton campaign chairman. And Mike Rogers, the former Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee. And this is a Democrat, this guy. Now, the Alliance for Securing Democracy is, according to Max Blumenthal, the researcher, is a factory of modern-day McCarthyism, where it brands alternative media outlets as, quote, vehicles for Kremlin propaganda, unquote. Now, let's go here. Okay, so now we have others that were put on this platform committee, nominated. Meraki Sellers, you've probably seen him on TV if you channel surf on CNN or on MSNBC. Meraki Sellers, Dan Shapiro, Wendy Sherman, and Megan Stabler. Let's go over them. In 2015, Meraki Sellers became a member of the National Council of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC. He led an effort in 2016 to ensure the DNC's platform did not adopt language that Sanders supported, which would have acknowledged the Democrats had a responsibility to confront the humanitarian crisis facing Palestinians in Gaza. Quoting Clinton, Sellers stated, "We must repudiate all efforts to malign, isolate, and undermine Israel and the Jewish people. We have to be a unified in fighting back against BDS, that's the boycott of Israeli business. As a CNN contributor, former surrogate to Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton, Meraki Sellers has consistently attacked Sanders, weaponizing his identity to consistently insist the campaign of the Vermont Senate has a long way to go with black voters. Okay, now we have Dan Shapiro. He's the former U.S. ambassador to the State of Israel who opted to remain in Israel indefinitely with his family rather than return to the country he supposedly worked for. So here's a guy that's living in Israel who is on the committee, the platform committee. He also wrote a column a year ago for the right-wing Jerusalem Post championing the virtues of expanded U.S. military aid to Israel. When President Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, he argued it could help end the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Okay? Then we have Stabler, was appointed to the platform committee. The Majority for Israel congratulated Stabler, who's a board member. Then we have Sherman. Sherman, former State Department diplomat and senior counselor for the Albright Stone Ridge Group, in 2016 was appointed by Hillary Clinton to serve on the platform drafting committee. She voted against a platform amendment that would have merely acknowledged Israel engages in a military occupation. She also opposed removing language that suggested that the BDS, the boycott movement, and anti-Israel resolution at the United Nations, she said they delegitimize Israel. The Albright, by the way, the Albright Stone Ridge Group is an influence peddling operation founded in 2009 by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. In 2016, Albright said there was a special place in hell for women who would not support Hillary Clinton. And, of course, we know what she did with the sanctions, killing the thousands of Iraqi children after the first Iraq invasion. Harris has nominated an array of U.S. government regime change operatives to ensure the foreign policy establishment enjoys total control of the DNC. And, you know, I can go on and on, but, folks, basically, this is the Democratic Party I'm talking about. This is not the Republican Party I'm talking about. We already know about them. This is the Democratic Party. So when you talk about 9/11 and you talk about the empire and you talk about the phony wars, we're playing cards with a stacked deck. That's why I think half the public who can vote doesn't even vote. And I'm not advocating that we shouldn't vote. I vote, okay? All I'm suggesting to you who are very nicely sitting here, you know, listening to me, is that we are living in a militaristic empire that is not getting any better. It's getting worse. Under Obama, who was a Democrat, in 2011, the percentage of federal taxpayer money that went to military spending was over 55%. Under the Bush-Cheney cabal, it was over 50%. So what I'm saying to you is that it seems it doesn't matter what party is in the White House or what party controls the Congress. When it comes to the militarism, things are not going to change under these two parties. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Well, thank you, Philip. I'm going to do a little stuff here. I muted a couple of people. It was my mistake. I was supposed to put us into lecture mode, which mutes everyone except the speaker. And since I don't do this job regularly, I completely forgot. So I had to mute a couple of people who were making a bit of noise, but you're now all unmuted. So I'm going to go put us into Q&A. And I believe it's star 6 that you have to type into your phone to go into the queue. That's one thing I should have double-checked on, but I'm pretty sure that's it. Wait a minute. I've got to unmute Philip. Okay, Philip, you were muted there for a few seconds. What's that?
Okay, do I have to go into the queue also, or I can just sit here?
You just sit there. You're good. And I've got one person already in the queue, so I'm going to have them ask their question, and then hopefully other people will join in. So the first question, the first question is James Hufford. James?
Hello. Thank you for your presentation. I really learned from it, and I guess from such a murky subject, I have enjoyed it. But I want to point out first of all that some of my recent work has been in the same direction, and I published a book last year entitled Colonel Crystal's Parallel Universe that went over a lot of the same points that mine is fictionalized, and I have a high-ranking military person getting on to what was really going on and making many of the same points that you made. Without the party politics, I didn't inject a single politician in my book, but many of the same points and that really indict this country and its leadership, not so much the people. The people want peace, but the leadership wants war, and the people need to figure out how we're going to win and overcome that and prevent them from the continuous wars. I don't know if I have that much. I guess my question is, what do you see as our way out of it? Do you see any remedy that maybe we can contribute to?
Yeah, of course. I mean, what I did where I live here in Central Florida, we organized a weekly, it was just an hour a week during rush hour. We would stand at a very busy traffic corner with signs against the Iraq occupation. And I think, and I'm gonna start doing that again. I haven't been feeling good, so I haven't been out there. Florida is terrible. The worst, if you want allergies, come to Florida. You got a lot of allergies in Florida. But standing in the town square or going to the office is even better. Going to the office of your congressperson and having demonstrations outside their office about the empire and about the military spending is something that we all could do immediately. And the more of us that do it, believe me, a lot of these congresspeople, especially, they want to get reelected. They have they have their own thermometers, you know, and if enough of the climate around them changes, I mean, they'll read the weather.
Yeah, well, in my book, Colonel Crystal's parallel universe, the remedy that the Colonel came up with was something called defense-only military. If we could have Congress completely outlaw any war in which going into any war in which we had not been militarily attacked, then we probably, the world lost 60 million people from U.S. Unnecessary wars since the end of World War II, and I think all of those could have been prevented if we had had defense-only military.
Yeah, that's a good idea, but, I agree with you, but right now we have to educate our fellow, our neighbors onto the facts.
That's true, and one thing is that it doesn't really reflect the ethic of the people. We don't believe in going over and killing a whole bunch of foreigners and becoming the rats of the world. I mean, that just isn't the people. That's just the neocons that
right.
have control of things or have had. Maybe that's changing. I hope it is. But,
well, Muhammad Ali made that famous line, and I'm sure a lot of people heard it. He said, "I ain't got nothing against no Viet Cong."
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that, as I read it, the citizens of this country, and it spread into the military, stopped the Vietnam War. They wanted to keep it going, and the people didn't want it and said they'd vote against anybody in Congress that wanted to continue the war, and the military said, "We're not going to fight anymore, and so how could you have a war?" And they
had a draft then. Yeah, I mean, we had a draft.
That
was the whole key. If we didn't have a draft then, if we had what we have now, honestly, it would have been a whole different scenario. At that time, we had the draft, and a quick example is my father, who was, I don't know why, my father was a longshoreman, and yet he hated the Democrats. He voted for the Republicans. He voted for Nixon, for Goldwater, and he was in support of the whole thing in Vietnam in 64, 65, 66. 1968, at a family dinner, when my brother and I could have gotten drafted, my father made an announcement to all my relatives. He said, "Before those two kids get drafted, I'm driving them to Canada." So things change when things change.
Yeah. Well, we don't have the draft, but we do have the fact that I figure from 1/5 to 1/7 of our gross national product goes into the war, and just about everybody is having horrible financial problems, and that's why.
Yes,
and people need to be educated. As to that, and maybe they'll oppose it.
Well, thank you for that.
Okay, thanks, James. Now, there's nobody else in the queue, and I can't believe nobody else has a question. I'm thinking that, wondering if we have a technical problem. I mean, it's *6 to get into the queue, and if nobody gets in the queue, I'm going to unmute every. Okay, we've got one. So I'm sure there are other people that have questions. I'm going to ask a quick question. Before I pass to the next one. Philip, you mentioned at the beginning, you mentioned kind of the how war is sort of sold, and the military is kind of sold to the public, and how they, at football games and things like that, there's so much of a, glorifying the military that goes on. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how propaganda is used like that to kind of sell people on the need for lots of military spending.
Well, I think the easiest way to do it is the lady, the librarian, who's a very nice woman. She's a friend of mine. She reads all my columns, and I always see her. And one day I went to her like 5 years ago, and I said, "Ann, I said, we got to cut this military spending. You read my column, it's like over half of our tax money goes to military spending." And this is Ann now, is not a political person, believe me. And she looks at me and she goes, yeah, but we have to defend ourselves. And that was it.
Huh.
The fear card. The fear card. Fight them there. I mean, everybody listening, remember this from 2003? Fight them there so they don't come here.
Yeah. I guess there's fear, and then at the other side, there's the kind of glorification thing that's going on, too, that kind of goes hand in hand, I guess.
Craig, they call our soldiers warriors, our brave warriors. They're soldiers, okay? And they shouldn't be in those places. They shouldn't have been sent to those places. But don't start calling them warriors. Did you ever see how these guys look when they're in Iraq? They look like Ed Norton from the Honeymooners episode, the man from space. You know, when he shows up at the costume party dressed in his sewer outfit, and the guy says, you might be late for the eats, Norton, but you're not late for the first prize of the man from space. Well, that's how these soldiers look. That's how these soldiers look, you know?
Yeah.
So it's crazy. It's you know what? It's surreal. How's that?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm going to put you over to our next questioner, Steve Stadola. Steve, you want to go ahead?
Italian boy. That's a nice Italian boy.
Yeah, right. Hi. Quick question. With all these people appointed to the platform committee, is there any chance of getting Bernie nominated?
Well, I'll tell you, they're going to do everything they can to make sure that he doesn't get nominated. And that's why I want people to hear this. I'm not a Democrat. I'm usually Green Party, but you know what I did here in Florida? I changed my affiliation, and my brother, who's a Marxist retired professor in California, he did the same thing, and he has more of a disdain for the Democrats. We both put our affiliation now to Democrat so we can vote in the primary for Sanders.
Yeah. Okay.
Great. Are you good, Steve?
Should also link it to the amount of greenhouse gases that the military is putting out too. So
yes.
That's another point. Besides the spending, you know, you've got the impact on greenhouse gases. So
yes.
We're having a meeting about that in Boston this coming week, I guess. I'll mention the spending for sure. That was really helpful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you have a congressperson, the only way these congresspeople are really going to listen, except for a very small percentage of them, maybe two handfuls, the rest of them, they're only going to listen if people show up at their offices and, you know, and demonstrate for one issue. You have to just do it one issue at a time because these congresspeople, they can't handle more than one issue at a time anyway, so, you know.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Steve. And now we're going to go to Charles Ewing Smith. He's the last person in the queue. So, Charles, do you want to go ahead?
Oh, yeah. Hi, Philip.
How you doing, Charles?
Listen, I'm just extremely frustrated with the whole situation because there doesn't seem to be any out at all. Because when bottom line, the entire United States economy is based on weapons sales and the military-industrial complex. All of our ability to float in the water, so to speak, is because we're selling weapons by the gazillions to anybody and everybody. So, solving our problem murders us, basically. I mean, if we solve the problem by reducing the military-industrial complex, we no longer have any income, and everybody's going to have to, you know, tighten belts and go back to, some bizarre time where we're all struggling again, like in the late 20s. Is there any way we can start shutting down the military-industrial complex, you know, with the cooperation of the world, of course, because everybody's going to have to stop selling weapons. But is there any way economically that we could ever strategize something like that where we wouldn't just destroy ourselves?
Well, I don't think, Charles, with all due respect, I don't think we would destroy our economy if we diverted the funding away from these military. Yeah, those industries would lose, you know, jobs. But first of all, the U.S. government, by eminent domain, should take over every single armaments company, you know, and make it nonprofit. That's the first
thing. Oh, that's great.
Saying, in general, don't let them fool you by telling you that, oh, if we cut the military spending like that, it's going to kill our economy. That's not true. Not at all.
Yeah,
money could be diverted. I mean, think about if we had, I'll give you an example. Think about if we opened up in every town, in every part of every town, a walk-in center. People aren't feeling too good mentally, emotionally, and you go to a walk-in center and there's a professional there, and you can sit down and talk to them for like a half hour or something. That would be government run, obviously, you know, but think of all the jobs you would create just in that one little thing. So there's so many things that we could do. I'll give you another example.
The eminent domain thing sounds like a home run to me. I didn't even thought of that.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, the government can do that, but what really gets me is when people don't know that over half of your tax money and my federal tax money goes to military-related spending. Oh, and right. And then they cry about not having the, you know, Medicare for All, and they're arguing over it. All these idiots, you know, running for office, they're arguing over it, and they're making Sanders look like he's with the Comintern, you know, the Soviet. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, they're very irresponsibly using fear. I mean, look at Russiagate. What an obscenity that was. You know, just a flat out lie.
Yeah, but here's what my brother said. My brother said this to me when the Russiagate thing was going on early. He said, Philip, whoever hacked into the Democratic emails, if the information released was true, what does it matter who did it? You know? So that was the premise. You know, that the Russians came in and they got the information, and they gave it to WikiLeaks, whatever.
Well, yeah, but the problem with all that, of course, is that nothing was hacked. They got everybody thinking, you know, people are pretty dumb, apparently, and they don't understand what hacking means. And they accuse the Russians of hacking into something. And, of course, it's been proven that the information was downloaded.
Was leaked.
It was downloaded to a flash drive.
Right.
And that's been proven.
Right, it was leaked. But the point I'm making is if there was a hack of anything and stuff, if the information released is true, what does it matter?
Yeah,
you know?
No, I agree.
Yeah.
But when you've got them thinking that Russia's attacking us secretly in a way that they don't understand, that just sucks. It's obscene.
Well,
I'm 76 years old. I saw the same thing happen in the 50s.
Oh, it's terrible.
With lies about Russia. This is just incredible.
You know, there's a wonderful movie I want everyone to be. I know I'm going to be off now, but I want everyone to think about this. I just saw it. It's called Red Joan. Have anyone heard of it? Red Joan, okay, with Judi Dench. It's a British production. It's a great movie. It's about the woman who was arrested in 2000 for giving A-bomb secrets to the Soviets in 1945 or 6. And they finally found out who she was, and they arrested her. But the movie is brilliant, and it explains what you just said, Charles, so about the whole thing with Russia
and
then the enemy. Yeah, yeah. It's called Red Joan. Great movie.
All right. Thanks, Charles. Okay. I was just going to say we had one more questioner, but we now have two.
Okay.
It was slow starting, but it's picking up speed, I think.
Yeah.
Can I ask everybody at this point, though, that we cut it off at this point? We have Dylan Avery and then Ann Hendricks. And so let's just cut it off at that so that we can move on to our second speaker. So let me just click on here. Okay, Dylan, you're on.
It's not Dylan. It's Sherry from San Diego.
Oh
boy. Okay. Technology is playing games with us tonight, apparently. So, sorry, Sherry.
But so anyway, I came on late because I was at work. And so anyway, from what I understand, we were talking about how we can stop the war machine, correct?
Yeah.
So, well, what don't we have to get all the dual citizens with Israel out of our government and solve 9/11 first, because that's what really is the solution. That's what I think. You know, we have all those dual citizens with Israel in there. We need to start honoring the 1940 Nationality Agreement, Section 401E, that says all people that work in our government, all positions like the comptroller and everybody, have to be 100% United States citizens. And you have to go back to the Supreme Court, Abe Fortress, way back when Lyndon Johnson was president. He appointed Abe Fortress, who allowed dual citizens with Israel to retain their dual nationality, but no other country in the world can do that. So that's when they started to do the soft coup and infiltrate, and now if you look at how many dual citizens with Israel are running our country, it's massive. So we have to honor Yankee White clearance and have only 100% United States citizens. That ensures loyalty to our country. And until we do that, I don't think we can have stop wars.
Okay, can I answer her, or is it okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Quickly, I'll be quick.
Sure.
It's Kerry, right, Kerry. Kerry, this is my theory on Israel. It's a little bit different than what you might, you know, the one that you might have, and I respect the one you have. But to me, Israel was always, from day one, was created as the junkyard dog for the Anglo-American establishment in the Middle East. They were our junkyard dog. So when people complain that AIPAC and Israel is behind the U.S., you know, Congress and the government making decisions, what I would add on to that is, it's the Anglo-American establishment, the big fat cats who are in that arena, they are behind Israel, and Israel does the bidding that they want. So I kind of see it a little bit differently.
Okay. Thanks, Sherry. So we're going to go to our last question now, and it's Ann Hendricks. You're up.
Hi, Philip. Thanks for speaking tonight. That's very interesting comment you just responded to Sherry's question. Thank you. My point is just pretty much the same as Sherry's point. Let's solve 9/11 first, get the criminals in jail, and then the other military people are going to have to answer and get our troops home. That's all.
Yeah, I'm a student of 9/11 truth, and, you know, I've read all the books and watched a lot of the documentaries, and, you know, of course, I can agree with the gentleman who's coming on next. I think wasn't he the guy who did the Loose Change film, Craig? Is that the gentleman?
That's the one, yep.
Yeah, that's an unbelievable, great film. No, I'm on board with the 9/11 or truth all the way. And, yes, we really need to continue to put pressure. The only way the truth's going to come out is that people that were inside of the beast at that time have to come out, you know,
absolutely,
more and more, and speak and
right,
and point fingers. Because, you know, it's sad. It really is. But it just shows you what H.L. Mencken said, right, about the American people. You know, I mean, the average person in this country only cares about their electronic gadgets, what they're going to do Saturday night, and if they're white and they support the people behind Trump and the right wing, then they're also worried about a black or brown kid going to school with their daughter, you know. So.
Well, thank you. We are seeking resolution, and we're not giving up, so we're a determined bunch here.
God bless you
thank
for
you.
That.
All right. Thank you, everybody. I'm going to end the session now. So, Philip, thank you very, very much for coming and speaking to us. We really – that was very interesting much appreciated.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Barry Zwicker, the gentleman you said, is that the gentleman from Canada that was a that they had a TV show, like a – was that the Barry Zwicker?
Yes. That's the one.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I have a radio interview show. Do me a favor. Can you get me, Barry, to contact me? So I like to do an interview with him, maybe on 9/11 or something.
I will definitely connect the two of you.
Yeah, you have my email address?
I do, yes.
Okay, so you can just see if Barry's interested, and we'll do a phone interview, okay?
Okay, great. Yeah, I'll make sure he gets in touch.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Philip.
All right, good night.
All right, good night. Okay, so let's move on to our second speaker. We're going to be hearing from Dylan Avery, who's, as Philip said, is one of the creators of the Loose Change series of films, and he's a documentary filmmaker. His last film, Black and Blue, was about police brutality, and it won Best Documentary Film at the Catalina Film Festival. He's been involved in a number of documentary films in recent years, and right now he is directing a new documentary for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth that will be that will look at Building 7 and the Hulsey Report, which will be the final version of which will be out very soon. So I'm going to. This time I'm going to remember to put it in lecture mode. And also, he's Kelly David is with him, and she's also involved in that film as well. So she may want to comment as well. So let me just put this on. And now I have to unmute. Okay, did I get? Yeah, I got to unmute Kelly, and I have to unmute Dylan. Okay, great. So are you there, Dylan?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Why don't you go ahead then?
Well, you definitely covered the introduction in your introduction. As you stated, I'm currently in the post-production process, editing for the Building 7/Hulsey Report documentary. It is both a documentary about Leroy Hulsey at the University of Fairbanks, Alaska, and it is also, it's about him and the study that he undertook over the course of 4 years and $300,000 to basically do his own analysis of Building 7 and what led to that building's collapse. So the documentary primarily focuses about him and his study, but of course you can't talk about the study without talking about Building 7. So it also serves as both somewhat of a refresher course and also an introduction to Building 7 that hopefully a lot of the people we reach with the documentary may not be aware of. You know, we're fast approaching 20 years since 9/11, which is crazy for me to say out loud. But we're kind of hoping that this can hopefully transcend preaching to the choir and can get out there and reach a new generation of kids and teenagers who may not even be aware that a third building collapsed on 9/11. I mean, even at the time when 9/11 happened, it was somewhat of a, I don't want to say a secret, but it was definitely a surprise to a lot of people to learn that a third building had collapsed that day. So we're, you know, really hoping to, you know, like I said, kind of tread some of the old ground while definitely taking a new approach to the material, and hopefully educating a lot of people who may not have been aware of the fact that Building 7 fell on 9/11. So it's pretty interesting. You know, we shot 3 interviews in the Berkeley area with Roland Engel, Scott Granger, and Kamal Obaid. And then we went on up to Alaska and we spent 2 days with Professor Leroy Hulsey at the University of Fairbanks, Alaska. And it was great. I mean, it was a good shoot. Like, we got some really good interviews. You know, Hulsey, I had previously met him because I filmed his presentation in Berkeley in September 2019 when he was kind of doing a presentation of the draft report and what the findings were that they had come to. But you know, on the trip to Alaska, I really felt like I actually got to know him. Both as a professor personally and both as a professor commenting on things from a professional standpoint and also kind of getting to know him as a person. So that was really interesting. And I think that, you know, that's to me, one of the appeals of doing this project is, you know, not only getting to kind of inform people about Halsey as a person and as a professor, but really this fresh new take on a subject that some of us feel that we've basically heard everything about. I think that the work that Halsey done is very important. And I think that from a technical standpoint, it may be the best thing that the truth movement has produced so far. And that's not to disparage the work of Stephen Jones and Niels Harrit, the work that they did on the nanothermite. But even that could be considered wading into somewhat speculative territory. So the thing that I really admire about Halsey and the work that he's done is that he stops his study and his research right where some people would expect him to keep going and to be like, oh, well, I've proven that the building didn't come down because of this, so here's what I think actually happened to the building. He stops himself short of doing that, which to me, I think, speaks a lot to his, I'm sorry, Gordo, what are you doing? He's been quiet this whole last hour. Now he's got something to say. Gordo, Gordo, stop. Sorry, guys. But yeah, I have a lot of respect for Halsey. You know, like he did a phenomenal job with the study. He was very, very scientific and very methodical about how he went about approaching the subject matter. And I'm really excited for people to see this. You know, I have a pretty strong opening and a pretty strong ending. So a lot of the things that I'm still trying to figure out is a lot of the middle stuff. But really the thing for me is just trying to find that perfect balance between talking about Halsey and his report and also kind of going back and covering the basic aspects of Building 7. A lot of the things that we've all heard about, but I'm trying to somehow find a fresh take on it as much as I can. And I think that I've done that, but I'm pretty excited for people to see this. And I don't know how many people had tuned in to the stream that I did with Jason Burmis, but there's still an eyewitness that we're trying to wrangle that was there that day and actually made some public statements, which can be verified because, again, he made them that day shortly after the building came down. But, right now we're trying to wrangle that, so we're really hoping that eyewitness testimony is kind of the icing on the cake. If we don't get it, we still have a very strong piece, but that's really kind of one of the big question marks lingering over the project. I know that originally the report was expected to be released at the very beginning of 2020. I know that they're still hoping to get it out soon. And we're also hoping subsequently that this documentary can release right around the same time, so it can kind of serve as a companion piece to the research. With that being said, I also don't want to rush it because there's really a lot of moving pieces that are going into this. And I really feel like it's a genuine new opportunity for us to basically reach a new audience and, like I said, kind of approach this material that some people are probably sick of hearing about from a potentially new direction. So that's basically it. I know that I said I would talk for at least 20 minutes about it. I don't want to just go straight into the Q&A. But Kelly, I don't know if you have anything to say. Kelly was with us for all the shoots, so she can kind of comment on the production and how things went and what kind of interviews we got. I'm also biased because I'm the director, so maybe it would be good to get an outside perspective. But Kelly, yeah, if you've got anything to say.
Oh, I have to unmute Kelly. Sorry about that. Kelly, okay. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Do you want to add anything to what? Yeah.
Sure. Everything went great. I was surprised at how well everything went, actually. We got some fantastic interviews, and as Dylan said, getting to know Leroy as a person and as a professor was great. His students adore him. He does an amazing job of teaching, and he went into that even during the interview. So getting to know him better was, made a big difference in, like, kind of the direction we wanted to go with this. That makes any sense. But it went great. The only thing I think I would add besides that is that we had a fantastic production team. Obviously, we had Dylan as a director. We had a great director of photography. Ryan O'Hara, is that it? Film? Am I getting
yeah.
it right?
Yeah, that's him, Ryan O'Hara.
And the sound engineer is Scotty Tipton, so it was basically just the four of us the whole time, but it went fantastic. So I'm excited about this and looking forward to Dylan's edit.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if nothing else, at the end of the day, it will definitely be the best looking and best sounding approach to the material, just because, again, we have some really, really high quality professionals, some people that I met out in LA and I always work with whenever I get a chance. Ryan just sets up some, I mean, like, it's Halsey's shot alone. I mean, it looks like a shot from like Bad Robot or something. Like, everything just looks so good. It's nice because like a large majority of 9/11 documentaries are really basically just talking head documentaries. And so while we do have some talking heads and some talking torsos, we do also have some really great B roll. You know, I got a bunch of drone shots around Alaska. So it's good. It should definitely be a very cinematic piece. And again, I'm hoping that, you know, at the end of it, you know, you feel like you've gotten a fresh take on something that you feel like you've already heard about a whole bunch. So yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm trying to think of what else to talk about, but I mean, it really just depends on what people want to know. And anything I might not have covered, you know, even Kelly like brought up a couple things. I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I didn't comment on like the quality of the footage or like our crew or anything. So yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah. Well, we can just.
All I was going to say is one of the things that we really wanted is we didn't want it to be your average documentary. Like, we needed this to stand out, to be different. And everything that we did, of course, yes, there were interviews and talking heads, but there, like Dylan mentioned, there's a lot more to it. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. So how are you guys okay if we move to the Q&A now?
Sure, I'm okay with it.
Great. Okay, I'm going to end lecture mode here. Hold on. Now I might have to unmute. Let's find. Sorry, I'm just looking for. Oh, there he is. Okay. Okay, so I've unmuted. Kelly and Dylan, and we already have three people lined up, four people, so we're going to have a good Q&A session here. So let's start with Barry Zwicker. Barry, you're up.
Great. Dylan, it's so, so great that you have been doing such good work since your original good work, and I can't congratulate you enough on that. Not only are you doing great work, but you're persisting in it. I do have a question. It's based on a very powerful quote that I heard years ago from American social critic Larry Ray, and he said, it's very brief, anniversaries are reservoirs of sacred power. And you noted that the 20th anniversary of 9/11 is coming up. I'd be inclined to say, because my question is to you and to anybody on this teleconference, what can we do, what should we do, what options have we to fight the giant Wurlitzer that is going to start playing, you know, before the 20th anniversary? The whole mountain, the tsunami of bullshit will, pardon my French, will be loosed on the public. We know it's just going to be a repetition of the official story, incredibly and regrettably. And so I think one of the best things we could do, I don't think you'd disagree, Dylan, is to promote your film in every place and every way we can. Having said that, I wonder if you have any other ideas about how to offset as much as we can the huge propaganda thing that's going to be unleashed on the 20th anniversary.
Well, first of all, it's great to talk to you again, Barry. And I still remember coming to see you up in Toronto back in 2006, and you gave us a...
Yep.
you gave us a great little interview. I think that's one of the benefits of this being wrapped up in the next month or so and being released coinciding with the Halsey report, in that there's time to prepare and there's time to strategize. Obviously I'm sure that, you know, the links to Loose Change will be flying all over Facebook and Twitter. But I would be very interested to see how much of a response this might get, when the 20th anniversary rolls around, and obviously leading up to it as well. So, you know, and again, really the appeal to this, the appeal of this to me, without harping on it too much, is just the fact that it stops short of speculating, because it's the one thing the truth movement has almost always been, you know, raked through the coals over, is like, oh, well, you guys are speculating, and what about this, and what about that, and how did this happen, and how did they pull this off? With the Halsey report, and possibly with this documentary as well, like, there's very little speculation or wading into the territory of trying to prove what it is might have happened, because that's when you start to get tripped up and people start to disagree. I don't want to get into too many details, but there's obviously some major aspects of 9/11 that have proven to be very controversial, because people have very strong opinions about what happened at these certain locations, and it has created a bit of a wedge that still exists to this day, and apparently for some reason is getting even stronger as of late. So I think that that's the one thing that the Halsey report and this this companion documentary have going for it, is that it's very careful to not speculate. And again, I have little hints that I drip feed throughout the edit. Like, I don't want people to think that this is going to be sterile and that, like, you know, there's going to be no discussion whatsoever about the alternatives, but I'm trying to do it in a very tactful way. So, you know, like, if someone starts talking about the extremely high temperatures that were recorded in the one piece of steel that was recovered from Building 7, you know, I'll have someone say, like, you know, there's only a couple things in the world that can create those kinds of temperatures. It's just, you know, and even the people we interviewed, like, I mean, it's not even really deceitful editing on my part. Like, the engineers that we interviewed were very, very careful to make sure that they didn't comment on anything outside of their expertise. A couple of them, you know, waded a little bit into the territory here and there, but by and large, it's very like, look, here's my expertise, here's my background, here's what I know, here's what I can say, and that's basically it. And so again, that's just, you know, for me, like, I made Loose Change, which I don't want to say was, like, mostly speculation, but obviously, you know, there's a lot of speculation in there, and just trying to piece together the dots of what may or may not have happened. So that's, again, why this is just such a fresh take for me, because it's like, there's no margin for error in talking about things that may or may not have happened. So I'm curious to see how this gets received, both when it is released and as it's potentially used as a tool leading up to the 20th anniversary. I think it's, you know, again, like, I read the Halsey report front to back twice on my flight out to California and to Alaska. And, you know, it's like, it's rock solid. Like, I don't know how many people listening to this call have actually read the draft report. And according to Halsey, there's not really that many changes between the draft and the final. I mean, you read through it, and, like, you know, it's, I'm no engineer, so, like, there's a couple things that obviously go over my head, but I mean, it's just a solid report. Like, and you show it to people, and, you know, if, you know, it's like, it's kind of hard for them to argue with it. And if they do argue with it, it's on, like, some superficial level. It's like, oh, well, I saw that this was funded by architects and engineers, so I'm sure that they were expected to deliver a specific result. And I mean, that's even something that I asked Halsey about on camera, you know, and, like, somewhat devil's advocate, but I was like, hey, like, being that this report and the study was funded by architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, did you feel compelled to deliver a certain answer? And he was like, no, like, I'm gonna go where the evidence leads me, and I don't really care who's paying for it. So again, like, apart from superficial arguments like that, there's really not a lot that you can poke holes in this study with. I mean, you basically have to just refuse to read it in order to disagree with it. So, I'm excited, you know, I'm really excited, and I think they've done some phenomenal work, and, I'm really curious to see, you know, I know there's a lot of discussion of hopefully getting Halsey on a bit of a speaking tour, going to universities, specifically engineering universities. Of course, the only problem is getting universities to agree to even have this discussion, which is strange because Halsey's not just some crackpot, like just ranting on YouTube. Like, this guy is an accredited professor with multiple qualifications in the engineering field, teaching, you know, right now teaching students in like a $120 million engineering building at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I mean, that was the other thing, like going into this, I didn't really have a lot of context for, you know, UAF, just because, you know, I'd only seen limited video about it and like limited coverage of it on the internet. But like going there and like actually seeing the facility, seeing the high bay that they do testing on, you know, they work on airplane wings and things like that in there. Like, it's very legit. So even just in that regard, I wasn't expecting that from what I had already seen of UAF. Like, walking away, I was like, wow, yeah, this UAF doesn't screw around. And not only that, their stamp is on the front page of the report. Like, I mean, for all intents and purposes, this report is sponsored and endorsed by the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which is huge. It's huge. So yeah, I'm excited. I don't know what else to say other than I'm excited. And, you know, I've got a good 15-20 minutes cut together right now. I'm still wiggling some things around. And of course, like I said, there's that big lingering question mark with our eyewitness. But one way or another, the final runtime on this thing will probably clock in around at least a half hour, maybe a little bit longer, but I'm also trying to keep it short and tight, and I don't want to make it long just for the sake of making it long. But yeah, one way or another, there'll be a nice short documentary coming out to coincide with this report.
All right. So we're going to move on to Mike Cook next. Mike?
Oh, gosh, I have no questions. Just thank you so much, Dylan, for all your work and reentering the fold. I hope you've learned a lot out there. I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I really appreciate that, man. And that's, you know, again, that's what I love about doing this. Like, I mean, this is a far cry from Loose Change. I mean, you know, Loose Change, I'm just cutting away at, you know, footage I ripped off DVDs on a small laptop. And, you know, apart from my interview with Marcel Bernard and my interview with Willie Rodriguez, like, there wasn't really any footage that was really my own. So I'm excited for people to see this just because we have some really amazing footage. It's just like extremely professional quality, which, you know, of course I'm not wholly relying on, but I mean, if I'm going to cut to a talking head to cover something, it's nice for the talking head to look and sound really good. So, I'm excited. I'm definitely bringing to the table everything I've learned since Loose Change. And also, but there's still bits and pieces of it in there that are, I guess, reflective of that. So yeah, it should be a nice mix of the new and the old, if I do my job correctly.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to go to Ann Hendricks now. Ann?
Hi, Dylan. My name is Ann. I'm new around here. I've only learned about it a couple years ago. And I'm thinking, well, first of all, thank you for all your work. Appreciate everything. We just awesome work. Thank you so much. Are you the only person who interviewed the one person who was actually in Building 7, Barry Jennings?
I am, as far as I know, the only person from the movement that actually did an in-person interview with him. And of course, you know, the BBC dug him up and did an interview with him after the fact, where he basically not walked back his entire interview, but basically denied saying things to me that he very much said on camera. And, you know, being that he's no longer with us, I definitely don't want to speak ill of the dead. And I mean, Barry was a great guy. I just want to put that out right now. Like, you know, Barry Jennings was nothing but warm and receptive, and I think potentially didn't really know what he was getting himself into when I asked to interview him about his experiences that day. But I mean, he didn't hold anything back. And like, you know, I specifically said in like my initial communication with him, is like, I want to talk to you about the things that you said that day that it seems nobody has really followed up with you on. I mean, just the fact that he said he was stepping over people inside Building 7, I mean, that's so huge, because again, like the official report, the official reports and the, all the official, I don't want to say statements, that's too blanket, but I mean, like everything that everyone says about Building 7 is that the building was fully evacuated. Nobody died inside the building. There were no recovery efforts needed, which is another strange thing about them destroying all the steel and getting it out of there, because there was no need to get all the steel out of there because there was theoretically no bodies or no people that were still trapped in the building. But, you know, Barry, he gave a straight up honest interview to us and didn't really think much of the consequences or what it meant. He was just like, yeah, this is what I saw that day and this is what I experienced and here's how I feel about it.
So, my question, for all the work and all the energy that has put into showing that it was a controlled demolition, how much research has been done with people who actually worked there and were supposedly evacuated early on, besides yourself? You are the only person who actually interviewed someone who happened to be in the building sort of after the fact, after the evacuation. Did you pursue Michael Hess? And do you know of anyone who has gone after the people who actually were employed in the building?
We actually were at one point working on kind of a back alley interview with Michael Hess, but I think he caught wind of what was going on, because we basically were trying to interview him through a third party. And I don't remember exactly, but I think that third party might have said something that they weren't supposed to say. And Hess's people basically stopped getting back to us. So we definitely tried. And again, you know, Michael Hess also participated in that BBC documentary where he basically said the same thing, like, oh no, there was no explosion. It was just the buildings collapsing. which again is strange, because Barry and Michael Hess both used the words explosion that day on the news. Outside of that, I'm not really sure.
Did you notice, you know, because that when he was calling from the window for help, he said that myself and two of my staff are with me, so there were other staff there from that office?
Yeah, the only problem is we don't have names for those people. Knowing the internet and knowing how super sleuth some people have gotten about this, there might be some identification out there for the city workers that were there. Unless it's something that was mentioned maybe in like a news interview or maybe in footage. Because there is, when Barry was first being interviewed on the news, I want to say it was ABC right there on the street. It's the famous interview. It's the only interview he gave that day. You know, Barry like leans over and he said, that's when this gentleman here heard my cries for help. That guy, I'm pretty sure that guy's name is out on the internet somewhere. I think someone figured it out, but like all things, it would be a question of tracking him down, getting him to agree to an on-camera interview. But it's also a question of whether he was present with them for the explosion, because I think it was just, yeah. Cause even from Barry's interview with us, you know, he basically said it was him and Michael Hess, alone inside the building. You know, Barry is like, you know, you go hide under your desk and I'm, you know, or you go pray to who you're going to pray to at all. Who I'm going to pray to. Mm-hmm. Cause it doesn't seem like we're going to make it out of there. So I'm pretty sure like for the vast majority of their experience inside Building 7, it was basically Barry and Michael Hess.
Don't you find it unusual that not much research has been done to pursue the workers? It hasn't come out?
I am not entirely sure. Again, it's just a question of being able to actually identify names. You could look at a list of firms that were inside that building and, you know, offices that you think might have still had people in it. But I mean, Building 7 was basically evacuated at like 9:30. And basically the only people that stuck behind or were still in the building were people that hadn't gotten the memo. So I don't know. I mean, that's a valid question. Don't get me wrong. I don't know exactly where you would start getting names and firms and trying to figure out exactly who to track down and, you know, who was there in the first place. It's a good question, though.
Well, again, thank you so much for your work. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Anne. And now we have Xander Arena.
Hey, Dylan, pleasure making your acquaintance. All right, so one comment. I personally would really love to see just a little bit in the new film documenting the pre-weakening explosives and explosions and work that was done on the building, because I have a feeling that our opposition at some point may later try to make the claim that they had to bring the building down because of whatever reason that they're going to offer. And if we can show that they were actively working on degrading it, you know, earlier in the morning, even before the towers fell, I think that would be really effective. I don't know if we can do it in the edit that you got. I don't know what material you plan on integrating, but I think that it could be a really neat feature to at least show that there was damage within Building 7 earlier in the day, such as the blown-out elevator car, the blown stairwell, that kind of thing. So that's one comment. Second comment is I've got a contact here in Arizona who is good friends with the person who runs the Sedona Film Festival. The Sedona Film Festival is going to be coming up, and I think that this individual would like to organize a screening of your film after the film festival, but basically promote it well in Sedona. And so if you're amenable or interested in that, you know, you or Kelly could get with me on that, and that might be neat.
Second question first. When is the Sedona Film Festival? I'm sorry, I would look it up, but I have my
yeah, I don't know exactly. I think it's sometime in February or early March. And they aren't thinking to have it integrated with the film festival. I think the idea is have it, you know, basically run in this theater house after the film festival is over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I understand. I'm just trying to figure out a time frame. Let me see.
Yeah.
February 22nd to March 1st, 2020. That might actually be possible. Yeah, because, I mean, we basically have to have this done by the end of February anyway. I mean, if you think that he can get the word out and he can get butts in the seats, I mean, it's definitely worth a shot.
Okay. Yeah, I think he might. The guy I contacted is pretty cool, man. He was a psychiatrist for the Army. He's a signatory to AE's petition. He's a good dude. And, yeah. So, all right. Well, I'll follow up with him and work with Kelly, I guess. I'm seeing about maybe getting that coordinated.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, whatever we can do to get the word out.
Okay, cool. Hey, third thing, man, and I'm sorry because it's a little off topic, but I really I want to say it while I've got your ear. The 2017 Las Vegas shooting was full of problems, and I ended up being kind of knee-deep in some of the investigation into it and unraveling a few features that have got me embroiled with the FAA. Also the Sheriff's Department there for medical records requests. I've made Office of Inspector General reports to a number of agencies, and I've gotten some interesting feedback from our government on this. But bottom line, my research tells me that the shooting was essentially orchestrated or coordinated by people that were intimately involved in 9/11. And we previously had Jason on this call, Burmese, and I could kind of mention this, and he said, well, yeah, you know, let's talk about it. Send me what you got. I haven't looked at it. DM me or whatnot. So it's interesting because I've tried that, and he's probably got a couple months worth of him attempts and no reply. So I don't know if Twitter is just not showing him my requests or if he's lost interest because I've sent an email or two. So I'm thinking it's the latter. But it would be really neat for you or one of you to just at least look at what I've uncovered, because I have a feeling that in looking at this, you know, when you approached Loose Change, it was kind of, okay, well, let's see if these conspiracy theorists are crazy, right? And then you start looking at it, and you're like, holy shit, there's a lot to this. And I feel like you might have a similar reaction with the 2017 Vegas shooting. I'm emotionally invested in it because I know how deeply you guys care about getting justice for that event. And I feel like the 2017 Vegas shooting may be a little bit of a backdoor into that same goal. So, anyways, I just want to throw that out there, and maybe we can rally with Kelly or whatnot, but I'd love to get you just at least maybe about 15 minutes worth of your time.
I got to tell you, man, like, that's not my expertise. I mean, I make films about a whole bunch of different stuff. Like, I've covered a vast amount of subjects since making Loose Change. And like, I also, it's hard to discuss 9/11 these days without immediately being associated with Flat Earth, Alex Jones, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing. Like, I'm sticking to 9/11. That's my thing. If I'm going to talk about anything, it's going to be that, because it's the one thing that I'm the most familiar with. I'm not, you know, there's plenty of other people out there that can talk about the Vegas shooting and the discrepancies with that, but I'm definitely not that person.
Okay.
The only reason I'm touching 9/11 again is because, as I've said, the Halsey Report is a genuine opportunity to take a fresh look at the material, and it is something that is still very dear to me. And like, I'm sure there's plenty of things that can be talked about with the Vegas shooting, but I'm not the person to talk about them. And I mean, that kind of dovetails into your first question. Like, if there's any significant things that I can point out that show that the building was significantly weakened beforehand, but I don't want to say the word explosion or talk about explosions unless there's a very good reason to do so, because that's, not to be redundant, but that's what I love about the Halsey Report, is it doesn't speculate with a how. It simply tells you what and where and when and how the conclusions that NIST came to are basically incorrect.
Right.
And I appreciate it. But again, I'm trying to do a very specific thing here that doesn't fall into a lot of the traps that we've found ourselves falling into.
Copy that. And that may actually end up being more effective for reaching a wider audience and opening a lot more eyes. So yeah, I respect that. Hey, last thing, and I'm going to drop, there's some exciting stuff with finite element analysis on the towers too. So,
Great.
Keep your head up, man. I think we're winning this fight.
Yeah, slowly but surely, right?
Yep, that's it. Thanks, Don.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Xander. Thanks. We have two people left. I'm going to jump on the end of this, so that'll make three. But we have Charles Ewing Smith next. Charles, you're up.
Oh, hey. Hi, Dylan. We met with Ray Zimmerman and Howard Cohn when we were going to do Confessions of a Non-Alcoholic.
Oh, my God. That is a whole nother conference call. Boy, an interesting experience that was.
I was in the middle of that, and it didn't turn out good.
No, it did not.
But Howard passed away, but anyway, so it's...
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah, so me and Ray are the owners of the script. But at any rate, I'm the executive. I was the original video team leader for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I was a video team leader when we came up with the first Building 7 film called Solving the Mystery of Building 7 with Ed Asner. And so the reason I brought that up is that I noticed you were contrasting, you know, your new film, which I'm really grateful you're making, and hats off, with what came before, as if what came before was speculative, and that Professor Halsey, because his is down to, you know, the hardcore numbers, that, you know, that was the only thing we could all count on. Well, I totally agree with you that actually that is the truth, but if you look at the two films I executive produced and made, whatever the names of the damn things are, The Demolition of Truth and 9/11 Explosive Evidence, I executive produced those and edited and did the sound on them. And I want to tell you, man, there's no speculation in those movies. And you were contrasting your new one because of Halsey as being the only thing that's true. And I'm telling you this just for promotion, you know, how you promote it in the future. There's no speculation in these movies that I can think of. It's the same people you're using to some degree.
Okay.
I just want you to recognize that I don't think that it serves the purpose of the new film to contrast it like in a general way, like saying, oh, those films that came before, they don't have, I can't find any speculation in my movies. I don't think if you're going to do that, you know, you might say that the 9/11, the Architects and Engineers documentaries are the exception.
Well,
there are
I mean,
that are the,
But again, I was referencing my work in Loose Change and how the Halsey Report documentary is different. I've never seen your movie,
exactly.
So I can't comment on those.
Well, I see the arc. See, I see your arc. That's why I'm mentioning it, because you're missing the big island in the middle. So you're jumping from speculation to hardcore science, and bravo, and I'm so grateful you're doing it. But I don't think it serves it to contrast it to the films that Richard and I and the team did. I mean, it was all – and also, here's the thing. Do you have a budget?
Yeah.
Okay, we had no budget. Everything we made was volunteer. And so for it to be science-based, volunteer, and be elaborate as it is, I think that, you know, you should acknowledge that there is somebody who did work before you did. Loose Change was a groundbreaker. But in terms of science, the 9/11 explosive evidence nails it down pretty well.
Okay, so now we're moving things of the older documentaries, and now we're making newer ones about the.
Yeah, I'm not.
And the only thing that Dylan said was speculative was Loose Change. He didn't say anything about architecture.
That's not true. I sat here and listened to it, and it's okay, fine. I just felt like, and I'm not offended.
No, none of us feel
that
way.
I just think that it doesn't serve. Huh?
None of us feel that it was speculative. No one at AE is saying that, thinking that. Dylan's never said
it. That's why I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to Dylan. And you weren't there anyway. But Dylan, you hadn't gotten there yet. But Dylan, I just want this to succeed. And so my main purpose of talking was about how are you going to release this? Now, I've been involved with trying to release these movies and get them out there. And in my case, the one I made myself, the Demolition of Truth, I did actually win Best Documentary at the New York Metropolitan Film Festival, and it won some other awards too. So I got it out through film festival, and I got it out through Colorado PBS. They've showed it and used it as a fundraiser. But how are you going to get this in front of people's eyes?
That's what we're working on. With all due respect, it sounds like you just want to talk about yourself and the films that you've worked on.
That wrong. I've been working on this for 10 years, trying to figure out how to get this stuff in front of people's eyes.
Okay.
Then forget it. Good luck, Dylan. And, and I really like your work and I like you. So I'm just concerned about how this stuff gets out there. And if you're going to characterize it as you're the only one that isn't speculative, I think you're making a mistake.
That's not what I'm saying,
okay.
Man. You're really twisting things.
On the call realizes that.
I don't know. I'm right. My life.
No
last 10
so.
Years.
Buddy, it's been my life since 2002. I'm sorry,
yeah.
I got you beat.
Well, Richard lived at my house for a week while we were working on it. I mean, come on.
I think we want to move on to the next question.
It's ridiculous.
Well, I guess I'm the only one that cares. Okay, bye.
All right, bye.
Okay. Well, we have Sherry now. Sherry?
Hi, this is Sherry Jacobs Aspen in San Diego with San Diego 9/11 Truth. And I was sitting on a couch in 2013 recovering from a terrible car accident, and I discovered YouTube. And I discovered this documentary called Dark Legacy, JFK to 9/11, and that made my eyes open, and then it rolled over into Loose Change.
That's
and
amazing.
So you're responsible for changing my life.
I'm so sorry.
And that rolled over into Architects and Engineer, and then by that time my eyes were bugged out, and it put me on that rabbit hole to research, and then calling up all my friends and family and telling them we have to do something, and them thinking I was a nutcase. And so, thank you, sort of. So, anyway, but I do appreciate you and love you for all your courage. And I guess where I'm coming from with this is And I immediately tried to, you know, I learned about San Diego 9/11 Truth and Ted and Elise Muga, who started in 2006, and we're still pretty active. And then I got with TAP, and then I got on Architects and Engineers Verification Team, and I ended up with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiries, so I'm working very closely with them. And I kind of, where I'm coming is, I'm kind of like the 9/11 Unity Sister, like the thing that just went on with Charles and you, that hurts my heart. You know, I think that we need to really, that you know, the atomic doomsday clock was just moved last week to 100 minutes to midnight. Midnight is goodbye Earth as we know it, guys. So you, all of these people on the call, all of George and Charles and Richard and especially my heroes, the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, we are all a very special, incredible group of people that are saving the world. And I believe that this 9/11 is the key to it. We've got, like David Meiswinkel says, we got our foot in the castle now. And so we all have to be unity. So I'm for taking it on the road, but Dave Meiswinkel's coming here to San Diego on March 6th, Friday, and we've got the Mission Valley Library book from 2 to 5. And I'd like to invite you, if you're going to, I don't know if you live in California, but if you want to come on down, I've got an extra guest room. I mean, come on down and join Dave Meiswinkel. I'm sure he would be honored to have you. I think we should take it on the road, and we should put Christopher Joya, who is our angel from heaven to our mission, and you, and you know, and beam in Leroy, and have a, like one, six events for 1 year, one every month, and take it on the road. Go and take this to the United States of America people, and really make a big deal out of it, you know, and that we should never argue anymore about any of it. And we should only get behind the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, because those guys are our Ben Franklin, and all of you guys are helping so much that we just have to really have unity. And I'll stop preaching, and thank you, and I love you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I am unfortunately in upstate New York for the immediate future. Otherwise, I would take you up on that. But I definitely appreciate your enthusiasm, and yeah, I hope it's a success.
All right, thank you, Sherry. I'm going to ask the last question here. I was just curious, and I think you kind of touched on this, Dylan, but I was just interested on a personal level how you felt over the years being so identified with Loose Change, and what made you decide that this was a good time? I mean, other than the fact the opportunity came up, but what makes you feel that this is a time that you're comfortable kind of returning to the 9/11 subject?
Well, you know, it kind of circles back to what I was saying earlier about the chance to basically reach a new audience. I mean, you have kids that are in high school now that are learning about an event that happened before they were born. And for me, 9/11 was basically the end of my high school and the welcome to the real world. So just the fact that that amount of time has passed, you know, it's definitely a chance to get the word back out there and to kind of educate a new audience and to put out a new piece of information, instead of people are like, oh, you know, whichever film, it doesn't have to be Loose Change, but like anything that was made between like 2002 to 2006, they're like, oh, that movie's old, you know, it's like, give me something newer. So, I mean, this is at least an opportunity to do that. Yeah. And just the fact that Architects and Engineers, you know, they put a call out to their donors. They raised a budget. You know, I had the ability to do something that I didn't have with Loose Change, which is to travel and shoot interviews and get to spend time with people and, you know, really produce something that at least on a surface level is very professional. So, yeah. And, you know, I guess, you know, going back to the first part of your question, like I definitely had, I don't know exactly how to explain this, but I mean, yeah, obviously it was a bit of a shock that this thing that I just kind of made in my spare time, because I was sick of trying to explain how I felt to people. And I just figured it was easier to hand them a DVD and take it home and watch it on their own time. Like, it was a bit of a shock that suddenly we were being called the first internet blockbuster by Vanity Fair. And, you know, like we were getting emails from all these different news organizations, and like people wanted us to come and speak at their universities and come to rallies. And I mean, the amount of free DVDs we were mailing out on a daily basis was just insane. I mean, for anyone who was around at the time, you know, we had a pretty big, bold message at the top of our website. Like, we will gladly send a free DVD to anyone who was affected by September 11th. And I mean, that's honestly what our secretary Christie spent a large amount of her time doing, is just packaging and shipping out free DVDs to people who were like, hey, I was there. I was in lower Manhattan on 9/11, and I didn't lose anyone, but I saw what happened, and it still kind of sticks with me to this day. Like, all right, here you go. Here's a DVD. But yeah, I mean, I definitely had a mixed relationship with it over the years. I mean, I definitely, it's something that I obviously care about and I was very passionate about, but I wasn't anticipating that it was going to define the rest of my life and that I was going to have to spend the rest of my life talking about 9/11. I mean, even, you know, I would imagine even 9/11 family members, like, they don't want to talk about it all the time. Like, I'm sure some of them are just now getting to the point where they can still kind of, I don't want to say comfortably look back on the day, but, you know, it's certainly not as painful as it used to be. So, I mean, I don't think anyone really wants to spend the rest of their life talking about 9/11. I mean, it's just such a depressing subject, just in, not only in terms of what happened that day, but the long lasting repercussions that it's had on our country, and the fact that it continues to shape our foreign and domestic policy. And yet here we are 20 years after the fact, and it's still, you know, subconsciously or consciously informing everything we do. I mean, it's a lot, it's heavy subject matter. And it's something that a lot of people still to this day don't really want to talk about. So yeah, I mean, I definitely had my period where I didn't really want to talk about it, and I didn't really want to answer the emails about loose change and, you know, 9/11 and all that. I needed a break. I needed just a little bit of a break. So, you know, we made American Coup in 2009. We had Daniel Sunjata narrate it, which again was nice, because if at that time I was going to do another edition of Loose Change, it needed to at least have something new to bring to the table. And, you know, it was on Netflix for a couple of years. So, I mean, that was great. And I mean, after that, I didn't really feel like a particular need or a desire to revisit it. I basically had said everything I was already going to say and then some. But yeah, so that's even more so why it's nice to have taken a break and to, you know, step away from it for a little bit and make films about different subject matters and make some serious stuff, make some fun stuff. You know, I directed a short film. I directed a whole bunch of music videos. Like, I've been all over the place. So it's been nice to, and you know, not only that, but just to have all that experience and to come back to this subject matter as, you know, a different filmmaker and a different person. So, I'm excited. You know, I was texting Kelly, cause I was like, I was going through the NIST archive, which, as you know, is like 2-3 terabytes of footage. And I was just like sitting there just going through shots and just trying to find stuff, you know, not just of 7, but just like some shots, you know, around Ground Zero. I mean, you know, we have like the raw tapes from all the major broadcast networks that were down that day. I mean, there's one shot that I have where there's the burning Twin Towers and Building 7 in the background, and the foreground, there's just this mother like cradling her baby. And it's just like this crazy juxtaposition between, like, first of all, the human aspect, but also if you take the time that's passed into consideration, that baby that's on screen with the Twin Towers burning in the background is now in college, which is just insane. Yeah. It's just insane. So, but I was texting Kelly as I was going through. I was like, I can't remember the last time I like stayed up until midnight, like just going through footage of 9/11. It's something that I never thought I'd do again. But, you know, that's the nice thing about just having this new angle on it and just a new reason to talk about it. I hate to belabor the point, but I mean, if me, the guy who made Loose Change and made, you know, 4, you know, plus editions, if you count recuts and stuff like that, like, if I'm excited to sit down and work on something like this again, then I hope it's at least a sign that it's going to be something, you know, I don't want to say exciting, but, you know, it's new, it's different, you know, it's a new reason to talk about this stuff. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. So that was a good note to end on, I think. So, yeah, I want to say thanks very much to Dylan and to Kelly for coming on the call and talking about this film. I think we're all looking forward to it. So now I'm going to get us out of Q&A mode here. And, of course, you guys, you know, welcome to stay till the end of the call. We're just going to do some announcements, and then and that'll probably be – okay, where – oh, yeah, I see. All right. Now, so we're going to go to announcements. Now, I have to figure out how to Okay, got it. Okay, so everybody's unmuted now. So anyway, thanks again, Dylan and Kelly, for coming by. That was really, really interesting. So now we're going to go to announcements. And does anybody have an announcement of something coming up?
I do. This is Sherry in San Diego. I kind of already said it. But we're everybody's invited, if you're around the area, on March 6th at the Mission Valley Library from 2 to 5. Dave Meiswinkle is going to come, and we're trying to invite the public, you know, and it's supposed to be a really nice room in the library. It's close to the trolley, and there's lots of free parking. So if you're in the area, please come.
Great. Thank you, Sherry. Anyone else? That's a record. That's the quickest announcements we've ever had. how can we do it this way all the time?
Oh, hey, Craig, sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
All right, Xander here.
Oh, you got one. Hey. Oh, Xander. Okay, so you're gonna ruin my previous statement that we broke the record, and now we're gonna. No, I'm kidding. Yeah. So go ahead, Xander.
I got good announcements, but I'm holding them close to my chest. This is actually a comment about the teleconference itself. I'd really love to see us get migrated over to another website, like maybe Google Groups or something like that. Because like right now, we've got the Yahoo email address. For example, I can't figure out how to get the emails into like an aggregated or consolidated form. So, you know, it would be nice to get us back on a group message board is my only comment.
Yeah. I'll just make a comment on that. And I absolutely agree with you. And if you know more about Google Groups, that's kind of funny because I know zero. So I'm sure you do know more than I do. You know, maybe we can touch base on that, because as many people or some people in the group may be aware of, we were on Yahoo Groups and for quite a number of years, and it seemed to work just fine until they announced that they were changing their policy and basically deleting all of the past messages, 8 years worth of messages, and it basically sort of all we have left is basically emails. We have a collective email that we can go back and forth, but the group as we knew it is gone. So I totally agree, we need to find some alternative. One of the big message groups that I read about is called IO, and I thought, oh, that seems to be very popular. And then I read their terms of service, and on there it says that one reason that they can kick you off is if you're promoting conspiracy theories. So I thought, well, maybe we don't want to go there and then have all our new archives deleted just like Yahoo did. So yes, we'll definitely try to figure that out. So,
okay,
great. Anyone else have a comment or a question? All right. Okay, well then, I think we've come to the end of our call. Thank you everybody for being a part of it. Thanks to our speakers. And so we will all be back on the next teleconference on Wednesday, February 26th. So good night, everybody.
Yeah, good night.
Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye, everyone.
Night, night.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.